West Legal Ed Center and Law Biz Management would like to welcome all of our participants to How Do You Fully Leverage Paralegals? We'd like to thank you for joining our presenters, Ed Pohl, a principal with Law Biz Management, and Cynthia Mascio, a paralegal with Rutan & Tucker. Please note that this is an audio-only program. Again, thank you for joining us, and I'll now turn things over to our moderator, Ed Pohl.
Thank you, Tom. The way the introduction went, it looks as though we're abusing and misusing paralegals. But the idea here is to understand how the paralegal profession interacts with the legal profession and how lawyers can best use paralegals to become more effective with their clients and more efficient in the delivery of their legal services and thus serve the interests of all concerned. Our guest today is Cynthia Mascio, who is a paralegal and one who's been honored in her profession. So let's start right away. Cynthia, let me ask you to talk about how paralegals differ from other folks, such as assistants, secretaries, and the like.
Well, one of the main differences between a legal secretary and a paralegal is that a paralegal has taken additional educational classes and has become certificated through those classes. The paralegals aren't required to have any kind of additional educational. And paralegals are often been in the profession for a while, and they understand the ins and outs of the office.
So in other words, secretaries are not blessed with any certification by anybody, normally speaking, and paralegals, at least in the state of California, are certified in order to maintain and use that phraseology. Is that right?
Well, there's a difference between certified and certificated, and this is something we even have to explain to paralegals a lot, and that is even if you go to school to an ABA-approved school and you receive a certificate at the end of your education there, you're not certified. Certified is by taking an exam offered by the National Association of Legal Assistants or the National Federation of Paralegal Associations. There are national organizations that administer these kinds of tests. They're usually two-day tests similar to a bar exam and cover a myriad of subject matters. And that's how a paralegal is certified.
Okay, so then it really does have a national scope in terms of definitions and standards and skills and so forth.
Yes.
I know that it was a couple of years ago in the state of California, a bill passed by the legislature, which now is part of the Business and Professions Code, that outlines continuing education requirements for paralegals under the supervision of lawyers. Is that kind of a provision included by the national associations, or is that kind of provision extant anywhere else in the country?
Actually, California stands alone. The law has been around for 10 years. We just we celebrated 10 years this year in January. Business and Professions Code 6450 that sets forth in detail what a paralegal is, what kinds of tasks they are allowed to do and bill for, the educational requirements, the continuing education requirements, and we are the only state that has a statute. Now, there are several other states that have regulations pursuant to Supreme Court rules or their professional rules of conduct, but they're not law like it is in California.
Well, I think one of the keys that you mentioned, it certainly got my ear standing up a little bit, and that is bill for. So in other words, attorneys throughout the country, if they wanted to look at their own jurisdiction, if their state bar or their Supreme Court has such provision, or the Business and Professions Code section you mentioned here mm-hmm. in California, that they hire people for that paralegal position, and if they have those skills and so forth, then they are entitled to bill for their work, right?
Absolutely.
So in other words, that becomes the best use of leverage, and that's how, at least in terms of the title of our program, we're talking about using paralegals. Because if the lawyer has inside his or her engagement agreement a provision for other lawyers in the firm or other or paralegals or other persons in the firm for which the client will be billed, then it's legitimate. And here now you've got somebody with the appropriate skills to be able to be a timekeeper, in other words.
Absolutely.
Is that how you see it?
Yes, and in fact, in California, a paralegal has to be Business and Professions Code 6450 compliant in order for attorneys to recover their fees. So if you want to get attorney's fees in a case and you want to get paid for your paralegal's time, you have to be sure that that paralegal in California is compliant with all of the requirements under 6450.
Okay, this is obviously a classic use of the principle of leverage where you're having other people do work that you could do but don't have to do, and you can do other work that only you as the lawyer can do. And that's the highest and best use of your skills and the skills of other people in your firm. Let's talk a little bit about the types of paralegals that you might find. And, oh, by the way, just by way of a side note, if you in your word processing program were to type in paralegal, it would pass muster in the spell check. But if you type paralegals, at least in my version, it's going to come up with a question mark. For some reason, paralegals, plural, is not yet a word in the English language. How do you explain that?
I didn't even know that. Well, it's been an uphill battle, frankly, for a long time trying to get people to really understand what a paralegal is, what a paralegal does. I think there's been a lot of confusion. I think Business and Professions Code 6450 helped to clear up that confusion, but you'd be really surprised how many attorneys out there don't know about it still after 10 years.
Well, my experience has been that there are a lot of people that are either not certified or certificated, and yet they're doing work that both they and their supervising attorney think is paralegal work. Have you seen that?
I see that a lot. And, you know, the only explanation I can give is that, hey, if their clients are going to pay for it, and if they don't want to recover the fees at the end of a case, then I guess that's their business. But a person who holds himself out as a paralegal under 6450, at least in California, really can be convicted of a misdemeanor.
Well, that's a pretty hefty penalty, especially when you consider that if you are convicted of a crime, you might be examined by the state bar for malfeasance and violation of the rules of professional conduct and other provisions as well. So let's go on, though, and assuming that the attorney understands how to hire for a paralegal, how to use the paralegal's skills and attributes, and is appropriately billing for their time in accord with the rules of professional conduct of their particular state, what are some of the types of paralegals that we might find? I know we can define it in terms of time. In other words, you could have a permanent person and a permanent employee who's a paralegal. You can have a part-time. In terms of part-time, though, are there organizations that hire out paralegals on a temporary basis as they do other kinds of employees?
Oh, sure, absolutely, especially on large cases. I worked on a case at a very large firm, international law firm, at one of their branch offices in Newport Beach, and I was actually hired on as a temporary contract paralegal to work on a multi-billion-dollar class action lawsuit. They can be hired just to help in document reviews. Many times, paralegals are hired for temporary assignments. And that can be either through a staffing agency or even directly through the law office. A lot of law offices have provisions in to hire part-time or what they call contract paralegals and treat them as they are permanent. That's how I was treated. I mean, I actually started to accrue vacation and all sorts of things, and that's not how it is normally. But paralegals are definitely hired on contract basis, much like attorneys can be, too.
It's interesting because I know there are contract lawyers, and I know that there are organizations, a couple of big ones in the Midwest, that have some very outstanding lawyers who have taken either at the end of their career or at the beginning of their career as a career path to do temporary or part-time work. But I had not realized that paralegals were in the same category, that they are engaged by staffing agencies.
They're engaged by staffing agencies, and they are freelance, where they make the direct contact with the attorneys. They go out and market themselves. They go out and set up assignments directly with attorneys. They could be working for three or four attorneys at a time.
Well, yeah. That brings up the other issue in terms of definition, and that is if you do that, to some degree, you're what some call a virtual paralegal. Is that right? Is that the term that's often used by them?
Well, that's only if you're working remotely. What we were just talking about with regard to freelance paralegals that are actually live bodies that go, for instance, will go to one of the local bar associations to a mixer to drum up business because they're going to come in to the office, or they might work from home, but they would come into the office and work for one attorney maybe one day, another attorney the other day. The remote paralegal works solely remotely. Doesn't ever come into an office.
Okay, so some folks call that a virtual paralegal, and it was interesting because I had a conversation just a few days ago with somebody who says there's no such thing as a virtual person. And, you know, they're a real-life person, and they're in a physical location somewhere, but as you say, they may be working remotely with the technology that we now have. And, of course, if you're looking at it from the legal perspective, that is the legal profession perspective, it's a familiar phenomenon when you take legal work and, quote, outsource it, unquote. In other words, send it to India or to another office or, you know, elsewhere in the United States. But that's outsourcing. Somehow we did not get encumbered with the phrase a virtual attorney. But it seems to be virtual assistant, virtual paralegal. But it's really just outsourcing. And
right.
To what extent is the legal community aware of and actually using the outsourcing of paralegals?
Well, I have found that in the large law firm environment and really in medium-sized environment, they're still leaning towards permanent employees, mostly because of the potential for longevity and the resulting benefits of increased expertise, consistency of client contact, and the stability of the firm culture. And that's a real meaningful aspect of employment of paralegals because paralegals can really build a bridge between the lawyers and the clients and be the conduit. And if you have paralegals coming in and out of your office, you're not going to be able to build that rapport.
So one of the advantages then of having a paralegal work in your law firm environment is to be that bridge between the client and the attorney. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that is a very valuable bridge to have because, you know, lots of times clients, depending on the kind of law practice you have, lots of clients need a lot of hand-holding. They want to know what's going on in their case. They want to know what's coming up, and the paralegal is the primary person to answer those kinds of questions. Then that gives the attorney time to really practice law and work on their client's case with the quality service that their clients deserve rather than constantly being on the phone answering questions.
In other words, it's difficult if you're making a fee application before the court to justify hand-holding as a legal fee, but you might be able to get away with it if it's the paralegal that's doing the hand-holding, right?
Correct.
That's an interesting concept. So here now, you're doing something that the client needs. That is, you're giving the client information, but you're not charging them the full rate.
Right.
Okay.
Well, you're not charging them what the attorney would charge them, but they will still get billed for that time.
But they'll be billed at a lower rate.
Oh, yes, a significantly lower rate.
I remember one of my clients years ago taught me a very important lesson, and he was he figured out one day that he probably had somewhere around 125 calls a day, and obviously a volume that if you're trying to do business development, you want to get, but if you're trying to do any work, you don't want to get. And his solution was, well, first of all, his analysis of it was that 80%, it's the old Pareto 80-20 rule, 80% of the calls came in were process calls, things, as you suggest, like, what courtroom do I go? What's the address of the court? How do I address? Who am I going to meet there? Who's going to conduct the hearing? So on and so forth. And only 20% related to actually legal things that the attorney needed to answer, not the paralegal and not the secretary. So he split the alphabet, and he had each part of the alphabet go to a different paralegal. And they would answer the questions. Client would go away happy.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was something that the lawyer needed to address, they would make a time certain for the attorney to call the client sometime after or before he went to court. So everybody walked away happy, and there was a certain way of organizing it that just seemed to make a lot of sense for everybody involved.
Right. And the attorney has to be very careful, though, not to give too much rope to the paralegal or expect too much of the paralegal in terms of any opinions that might be rendered during this conversation with the client. I mean, you don't want the attorney saying, just talk to him. You know what the answer is. The paralegal will have to be the one to say, hey, you know, that requires a legal opinion. I need to have the attorneys talk to you about that.
So that's one of the things that the lawyer has to do in interviewing and training and teaching the paralegal, to make sure that the attorney sets out the boundaries, the guidelines for the paralegal to follow.
Right.
Not assume that they know, correct?
That's correct. They will most likely know. They better know, really, because the tasks that can be performed by a paralegal are set forth both in the ABA model guidelines and in each of the states of the United States. In fact, NIFPA, one of the national organizations, has put together a comprehensive chart identifying the rules governing paralegals for each state. So anybody who's thinking about hiring paralegals can go to their website and look at this regulation chart to see what the regulations are in their particular state.
Cindy, why don't you give us again a little bit more slowly what that set of parameters are and where they can find them?
The parameters are, they've created a chart. This is the National Federation of Paralegal Associations that sets forth state by state what the rules are governing paralegals. And the website for that is kind of long. You want me to give that out?
Well, it's probably in the materials that we distributed with the program.
I don't know if it is, but the main website for NIFPA is paralegals.org.
Okay.
And if someone goes to that website, they can find that chart.
All right. Well, that's good to know. And also, the ABA has a set of model guidelines for utilization of paralegal services.
Right.
So our audience ought to, as a precautionary matter, take a look at that.
Well, we've included that in our materials as well,
right,
as the guidelines for paralegals set forth by the National Association of Legal Assistants.
Okay. So one of the advantages then of for the lawyer of working with a paralegal is that they can do more and charge the client less and therefore keep the legal cost to the client down to a minimum. Are there other advantages for the attorney?
Well, one of the advantages is that basically they get time. They get time to practice law. Like I said earlier, they're not having to deal with the details, the minutia details of things that relate to their cases. They have time to market their business, ability to give their clients affordable quality service, and their ability to work on more cases. Because if you have a competent paralegal that's taking pretty much half the work off your plate, then you're free to go out and get more business and make more money.
There's another advantage that I think we overlook sometimes, and that is if you're truly a sole practitioner, as with technology enabling you to do more in less time and with less effort, if you have a paralegal working for you, you don't have to hire another lawyer right away. You can postpone that decision. And
but
yet you can have the paralegal be part of the team. And always a team is better, not only in terms of the quality of the work, but in the enjoyment of the work, oftentimes, where you have the ability to bounce ideas off of somebody with knowledge of the area, even if they're not a lawyer.
Right. And there's another benefit that doesn't really apply to sole practitioners necessarily, but for a larger firm, a long-term established paralegal can be a mentor to their first years, which is done a lot because, you know, you learn a lot in law school, but you don't learn the practice.
Yeah,
you don't learn what goes on in a court. You don't learn how to file a document. I'm talking about litigation because that's my background, but I can't tell you how many first-year lawyers I've mentored.
Oh, yeah, I believe that. I remember when I first came out of law school, the secretary for the managing partner was a phenomenal mentor for me. I learned a lot from her. I learned how to practice law from her.
Mm-hmm.
It's just how to run a law firm, how to interact with your supervising lawyer when you don't know, when you haven't had that experience. Those are important lessons, and you don't want to burn the bridges. Somebody's already done that. Somebody's already learned that the hard way, and if you can benefit from those lessons, you ought to. So for the client, then, what are the advantages? We talked about having lower legal service costs, perhaps. We talked about perhaps a faster response time to a question the client might have. What other advantages might there be?
Well, I think those are the main ones, because clients are concerned, especially these days, about costs. You know, we're seeing more and more cases, more and more clients coming in that want flat rate billing. And that can really factor in on saving the client and the law firm money if you use a paralegal, because you're going to be using less of money of that flat rate. So, for instance, if we have a case that the client's only going to pay $10,000 to get this case done from A to Z, if you have an experienced paralegal working on it at a reduced rate, you're going to get more done and have quality services and not eat up that retainer or that fee as fast as you would if you used an attorney.
Right. And I know there's a large discussion, and has been for many years, about value billing, alternative fee billing, moving away from the billable hour as the pricing mechanism for legal services. And nobody really, at least on a large scale, has done that. There are some firms, some lawyers who do the alternative billing approach, some very successfully, and others just beginning to put their toe in the water. But I think that one of the motivating factors that will force lawyers today to look at the alternative fee structures is that in order to be competent, at least in today's world, according to the rules of professional conduct, you have to be reasonably competent with technology. And if you think about it, when you invest in technology, that's a cost. It's a cost to buy it. There's a learning curve cost as well. And if you use the technology well, you can do the work faster. If you do the work faster and you're billing by the hour, you're going to be charging less. And that means you have to spend more time marketing to get more clients in order to stay even on the revenue scale.
Right.
Whereas if you're using an alternative fee, a fixed fee, as you mentioned, I think,
mm-hmm.
And you can use the technology to your advantage, then you can get the work done more quickly. The client's happy because they know what their cost of the legal service will be, but you make more money.
Correct.
And using paralegals, I think, from our discussion, is another way of looking at this to be able to do the same work more quickly and, I think, more effectively. It raises the quality of the work if you've got good people.
Absolutely.
So what are the services? We talked a little bit about the boundaries of a paralegal's ability to do his or her work. What are some of the boundaries? How would you reframe them? What can a paralegal do? Or perhaps we ought to say, what can a paralegal not do?
Paralegal, speaking as paralegal who's been in this profession for a number of years, can do pretty much everything a lawyer can do, with the exception of four things. They cannot provide a legal opinion. They cannot represent a client in court. They cannot set up an attorney-client relationship, in other words, go out and get the client. And they must remain professionally responsible for all work. The attorney has to be responsible for the work, and they can't engage in the unlawful practice of law. So pretty much whatever your paralegal is capable of doing, let them do it, because it's going to help you, save you time.
So if we say that a paralegal cannot exercise independent judgment, in other words, not practice law.
Right.
What is it that they do? Because I know you don't do things by rote. So what is it that you do?
Okay, well, I'm going to speak from a litigation paralegal's perspective, because that's what I do. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I can write any document an attorney can write. I can research. I can write a motion, I can draft interrogatory, any discovery, I can answer the discovery, I can review documents, I can analyze documents, I can help with discovery plans, you know, figure out who needs to be deposed, who we can, what witnesses need to be interviewed. So basically, really be involved in case management at every level.
If you do all of that, it sounds to me almost, and I know the answer, but I want to put it out there this way, it sounds to me almost as though you're using independent judgment. So where is it that you're not crossing the line? How is it that you're not crossing the line?
We're not crossing the line because, at the end of the day, the attorney is responsible. So the attorney has to look at everything that you've done. He has to, you know, have input into it. He or she has to be familiar with what you're saying to the client, or what your discovery plan is going. Whatever you're doing, the attorney at the end of the day is responsible.
So, in other words, this raises another issue that many lawyers balk at, because most lawyers want to practice law,
mm-hmm.
and what that means is they want to have their head in the book, or they want to be in the courtroom, or they want to be negotiating the deal, whatever it is that they're doing, but they don't want to be back in the office running the business of law,
mm-hmm.
as I say. And here, what you're telling me and telling our audience is that the lawyer is responsible for the work of the paralegal, which means that the lawyer has to supervise the paralegal, which means the lawyer has to manage the paralegal, which means that the lawyer has to take time, some time anyway, away from his or her practice of law in order to do that. Is that right?
Yes, but I think the term manage is probably a little strong, at least the way I see it. To me, it's not micromanage, that's for sure.
But that's a different issue, right?
Right, and that definitely would take the attorney's time. But I think what happens is that over the years, just a relationship builds as you're working with a paralegal. But even at the beginning, especially, I mean, all the lawyer needs to do is, if something is going to be held out to be legal advice or fall under any of these categories that a paralegal shouldn't do, that's what he or she should look at. So it's not like they have to be side by side and the attorney looking over the paralegal's shoulder. It's just that he wants to be sure that whatever's going out the door, for instance, you don't want a paralegal preparing an opinion letter to, let's say, your insurance carrier about where the case is and where it's going. The attorney wouldn't want that to be happening.
Well, I mean, if the paralegal does prepare that, that's almost like ghostwriting, but the lawyer needs to look at it.
Correct.
Before it goes out.
Right. The paralegal can write it, but not sign his or her name.
Right.
And that's what I mean by the lawyer has to supervise.
Right.
Just like when they sign a motion. Even, you know, in my case, in my firm, if we have a first year or second year prepare a motion, the partner on the case is still going to take the time to sit down and read it and make sure everything that, you know, he wants in it is in it. So I don't think that's any different than what you would do with a paralegal.
Right, right. Okay. And It almost raises, I always go back to corporate America as a model. And so in this particular case, I think what you're saying is they're almost managing by exception.
And yes.
They're looking at the oddball or the unfamiliar work product of the paralegal to make sure it meets the standards. And they're periodically checking the other work that's being done to make sure that it meets the standards.
Correct.
Okay. So what are some of the things that the paralegal then can do with the client? We talked about motions and you know, the substantive part of the practice of law, but what is it that paralegals can do with the clients as a buffer between the clients and the lawyer, other than just answering the simple questions of, you know, what courtroom is it going to be and that kind of thing?
Well, the paralegal can be the one who talks with the client for fact gathering. For instance, I interact with our clients when I'm preparing responses to discovery. I can be the one to gather information, including documents. I would go to the client's office and talk to the people there who might have documents we need. So the paralegal can be doing all the legwork that you need to do to gather information for the cases and work with the client directly.
Okay. And let me switch a little bit by asking you, how is it that the lawyer is going to know he has the right person, the right paralegal?
Well, my experience is that the lawyer should carefully question the paralegal on their skills. A lot of interviewers don't do that, really question them. Like, if you have a litigation paralegal coming in and you're going to hire them, you want to know that they really understand litigation. You would ask for a writing sample to see what their writing skills are, because writing is very important for paralegals because they do a lot of research and research memos. And if you're in California, you want to be sure that the paralegal is 6450 compliant. You want to see that they have their log filled out, that they have finished their continuing education. I don't think we really talked about that, but we do have to have 2 hours of general and 2 hours of ethical continuing education in a two-year period.
So in other words, they're taking a number of courses that are very similar, if not identical, to the ones that...
Right. I misspoke. It's 4 hours for each, but it's every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, the paralegals often attend the same continuing education programs that the paralegals, that the lawyers do.
Now, you mentioned a log. Is there some kind of log, like a shipping log, a pilot's log, that a paralegal has to maintain?
Paralegal is responsible for the same way that attorneys, well, you guys have to report to the state bar. We don't have to report to anybody. We're self-regulating. We have to keep track of it on our own. So we've just developed a log that says, you know, we took a continuing education class on this date and how many CLE hours that you got. And me personally, I turn that into my employer every 2 years so that they know that I'm ABA, that I'm 6450 compliant.
Well, in your case, you're taking it on yourself to do that, but isn't it the responsibility of the lawyer to make sure that he or she looks and talks, looks at the log maintained or some evidence that the paralegal will maintain and then have a conversation with the paralegal about it?
Yes, it is. The way the law is written, it sounds, though, that the paralegal has to verify the hours with the attorney. So it's an affirmative action on the part of the paralegal. But if the attorney wants to bill out certain things by the paralegal and if they want to get fees later on, they need to make sure. And I just think it's prudent for all attorneys in California to make sure their paralegals are compliant.
And I would suggest that it's equally prudent for lawyers throughout the country, if they're going to hire somebody that has a nomenclature, a title of paralegal, that they follow the same processes and protocols to make sure that the people that they are employing are in fact skilled, are in fact tested. And
I think that employers should look at paralegals the same way they look at a first-year lawyer. Or, you know, depending, or any lawyer, depending on where they are in their career. I mean, you want to be, if you have a paralegal that's been working for 10 years, then you expect them to have that level of competency versus a paralegal who's only been there, paralegal for a year.
Okay. Now, let me ask you another question. It's sort of assumed, I guess, in our conversation thus far, but we all know that in most cases, a secretary time is not billed by the attorney, although in some cases I've seen where the secretary's time is billed and it's set forth in the engagement agreement,
right,
at least for some portions of the work. Why is it that we just assumed, I think, in the beginning of this conversation, we just assumed that the paralegal can and should be billed for his or her time? Why do we come to that? There's nothing in the code that says the paralegal can or should be charged for. Nothing in practice that says it's an entitlement on the part of the lawyer to bill for the time being spent on a matter by a paralegal. Where has this concept started?
I think it started at the very beginning. Paralegal fees are basically the same as attorney fees, the same premise. I mean, why do you charge a client so much money for an attorney services? The purpose of paralegals from the very beginning, when it first became a profession, was to help provide affordable legal services to the public through working with an attorney. So it's always been contemplated that paralegal time would be billed, and because they're looked at in the same way as an attorney in that regard.
So, and secretaries, for example, are not looked at in the same way.
Secretaries are viewed as overhead. Paralegals are viewed as timekeepers, just like the attorney.
Interesting. And, of course, if we go to a fixed fee concept in terms of pricing and billing, then all of this structure falls away because it's almost irrelevant. But the training is not irrelevant, and that stays in place. Meaning that the paralegals need to be competent to do the work that they're called upon to do, and the lawyers must maintain an element or a degree of supervision to make sure that they're getting the best work product for the client.
That's correct.
All right. Interesting. So part of our conversation may be moot 5 years from now when or if the billing mechanisms for the legal profession are altered. That remains to be seen.
That's true. And, you know, frankly, for someone who's a timekeeper, that might be nice. The paralegals, most paralegals have a billing requirement just like lawyers. And that can put a paralegal in a kind of interesting, precarious position at times because obviously we can't just make up work. We have to get it from the lawyers. So sometimes it's a little more of a burden on paralegals to meet their billable hour requirements.
Well, now you're talking about a similar psychological perspective from young associates in the law firm where they're expected to bill out 1,800 or 2,000 hours. And some have trouble in today's economy reaching that plateau. In your experience, you know, I just mentioned that lawyers might be billing out at 1,800, 2,000 hours, maybe more. The question of time, commitment, requirement, whatever the right word is, for paralegals, how in the industry have you seen it? Is there a set number of hours that many, if not most, paralegals have to attain in terms of billable work?
Yes. For instance, where I work, we have a 1,600-hour requirement a year, and it just depends on the law firm. Most major law firms have billing requirements, although, of course, as with a lawyer, if you work for, let's say you work for a plaintiff's firm, you won't have billable hour requirements.
Mm-hmm.
But defense, yes, and most, like I said, most large law firms. And 1,600 hours is actually kind of low. I've heard of law firms that...
Okay, that's quite a tough bar to hold. It's that's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, and then, of course, there's that problem with overtime and that sort of thing, which you don't have to worry about with an attorney, but you do with a paralegal.
Another interesting dichotomy, then, because the paralegal is not considered a professional in the same sense as an attorney is by the Department of Labor. And so vacation time, overtime, and the like have different parameters for lawyers and for paralegals.
That's correct.
So paralegals then are treated by the government, by the code, then just as secretaries or any other clerical person. Is that right?
Well, in a way, that's right. As far as the Department of Labor is concerned, not so much with the state of California and the statute, because the statute specifically states that paralegals are not to bill out, you know, for clerical work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of an interesting dichotomy there that, you know, the United States government views us as non-professional in that respect, so we're not exempt. But California, even in the law, says that we are not to do clerical work, and yet we follow the same Department of Labor standards.
Okay. Kind of interesting. You're riding two horses at the same time.
Yes.
Hopefully they're not going in different directions.
Yes. Sometimes we feel like stepchildren.
Right. I can see why. Well, from the revenue side, working with a paralegal obviously helps the lawyer, and it helps the lawyer in a number of ways we've talked about. Additional revenue, number one, additional work that's capable to be done by the lawyer, which means additional revenue, and yet a lower cost of legal services, which pleases the client.
Right.
On the expense side, let's look at that for a moment. What's the cost to hire a paralegal in today's world? I just was talking to somebody about the fact that first-year lawyers were getting $160,000 a year before the financial crisis, and today that's down perhaps for many to $125,000 if they're hiring at all, and it's not likely to go up very much very soon in many different practice areas. Is that trend duplicated in hiring of paralegals? Do they reach a plateau? And
yes,
so you can hire more paralegals for less money than you could earlier?
Yes. In this economy, that has happened. That paralegal salaries have gone down slightly, just as the attorneys have. But the cost of hiring a paralegal, obviously, is a lot less than hiring a first-year lawyer, because paralegals generally aren't paid six figures. It's usually, you know, it depends on the state, it depends on the practice area, it depends on the paralegal's experience and skills, it depends on if it's a small firm or a large firm. There are so many factors that go into the salaries of paralegals that they're really all over the board. You can have a paralegal, first-year paralegal, making $30,000 in one firm, but $50,000 in another firm. It's that different.
Wow. And, of course, that's certainly a lot better economically for the lawyer than having to pay a lawyer $50,000 or $80,000 or some
right.
number.
Right. And, you know, other typical paralegal costs are taxes and fringe benefits, allocated space, you know, whether it's a private office or it's a cubicle. Most paralegals have private offices. I'm talking about permanent employees.
Mm-hmm.
They have private offices, and they usually share secretaries with attorneys. So a paralegal will have a secretary who will do the finishing product. Like, for instance, if you did a motion, you'd give it to the secretary, and she would get it filed and copied and all that thing. So that expense is also included when you're looking at a paralegal cost. So the general overhead with the services that are provided to the paralegal within the law firm.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate for a moment. The economy is rough.
Mm-hmm.
Many lawyers have literally been fired from their position in the large firms. You've got new graduates coming out of law school that cannot find a job, want some job in the legal community. I mean, they didn't go to law school for 3 years, and they did not incur $100,000 in debt just to go drive a cab.
Mm-hmm.
No disrespect to a cab driver.
Right.
Intended. Why would I hire a paralegal when I could probably get a lawyer, though a young lawyer, to join my firm and be able to do things that the paralegal cannot do, like go to court and so forth? Why would I make that decision?
Well, you might make that might be a better decision if you're a sole practitioner and you do litigation. But that may not be so good an idea if you are doing real estate or corporate, because if you have an experienced paralegal who is still going to probably make less than the attorney, they can do the work just as well.
All right, so now you're suggesting that the marketplace is such that it still benefits the lawyer to hire a paralegal because you can get a paralegal with skills at a lower price than you could get a new lawyer who doesn't have the skills.
Right. And I think it depends on what kind of relationship you want, too. I mean, obviously, the lawyer, it's more of a one-to-one equal basis, and the paralegal would be working under the supervision of a lawyer. So, you know, what does a young attorney want? I mean, most attorneys want to go through and someday be a partner somewhere. Well, that's never going to happen with a paralegal. You don't have to worry about that sort of thing. You don't have to worry about raising salaries every year to match what all the other attorneys are being paid. Paralegals, that's not how it's done.
You know, I think you hit on something that's really important and that never shows up in the surveys, and that is the relationship between the parties. Many lawyers are afraid that they're going to teach a young lawyer how to practice, and then they're going to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And they may even take clients with them. And as you suggest, that's not going to happen in the paralegal world.
Right. Paralegals will, for the most part, if they're in a good working environment and they're being respected and treated as part of the team, they'll stay. They'll stay a long time. And they will become invaluable to an attorney.
Well, one of the things that we just touched on briefly, I think, is this concept of being a team. I think sole practitioners and everybody, even lawyers in a large firm, to a great degree are solo practitioners, just
mm-hmm.
under a different umbrella.
Right.
And we all thrive when we are working in a team. And the other side of that equation is that it's really a lot easier to sell your service to a prospective client when you can say, my team backs me up, and show them a secretary, a paralegal, and others in your firm that really do represent a team, and all of which get the job done for a lower cost to the client and yet not a lower fee for you.
Correct.
Okay. Now, what are some of the needs that you would suggest to a lawyer to be successful in starting a paralegal program? In other words, I don't have a paralegal working for me now. I have listened to this, and I'm persuaded that a paralegal could help me. I don't need to go hire the lawyer that I was intending to hire to help me out. I'm going to try it out with a paralegal. What would you say to that lawyer, to me, are the steps I should follow to be able to successfully hire a paralegal?
Well, first of all, you have to decide what level of paralegal you want, because that's going to make a difference as to where you're going to go find one. If you're the best place to start would be local paralegal associations. That is like the best place to start, because they allow you to post job postings on their websites, and then you can get a pool of people from that. You should go to your, if you know an attorney who has a paralegal, ask them if they know anybody. It's all about networking, I think, for paralegals.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really get a feel for what's out there by talking to people. But I would definitely suggest that they go to their local paralegal association, and they would be given step-by-step directions on what to do.
Okay. A good point. I know in our community there is a school, a junior college, that actually has a paralegal training program, and they teach people to become a paralegal.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of years ago, for one of my clients who was considering whether to hire another lawyer, which she really did not want to do because of the cost involved, did accept my recommendation to think about and hire a paralegal. And I said to her then that the decision really is an interesting one, because when you hire a lawyer, theoretically, you're not going to have the same kind of training involved to understand what you want, understand the law, and so forth. But when you hire somebody who's coming out of a paralegal school, they're new paralegals. You're going to have to manage them more. It's going to take more management time, more training time, more education
right.
time, and so forth. But you're also going to pay less money. So there's a trade-off
mm-hmm.
that we have, and I think that is going to be different for everybody. You know, one person will say, yeah, I want to take that new paralegal and teach them the right way, teach them my way.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to hire a lawyer because they can go to court, they can spare me, and there are certain things that I don't have to teach them because they already know it.
Right.
And then you have to balance the dollars that you'd have to pay to each one. An interesting dichotomy, and as I said to my client, you're fortunate to be in that position of having to make that kind of a choice, because that means you're successful. That means that you're growing. That means your practice and it is growing. Your revenues are growing. You're attracting more clients who think you can do good things for them. You can help improve the condition of the client. So that's a good point, a good spot to be in.
Right. And just to let you know a little bit about what a benefit is to hire paralegals, it's been said that partners account for 3 times as much general overhead costs and associates twice as much as paralegals. So that's really something to think about.
Say that one more time, please. I think that's important.
Partners account for 3 times as much general overhead costs and associates twice as much as paralegals.
In other words, paralegals get around for less.
Correct.
They're not so much of a burden on the firm and its overhead. An interesting observation. Cindy, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. I think that the idea of working with paralegals is one that's not thought about too often, and for clients who are becoming much more sensitive to the cost of legal services and the quality of the legal services, using paralegals may be an answer that we should seriously consider and implement. Again, Cindy, thank you for joining us.
And thank you for having me, Ed.